The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We've read many books in this office, David. You are very insistent on our continued education. One of my favorite books was written by a man in the 1970s named Adam Ferguson. We've talked about it many times before, When Money Dies. And, you know, you've told us over the, you know, the airwaves and here in the office that we see things go from the financial to the economic, from the economic to the political, from the political to the geopolitical. But there's a human element in every one of those levels. And probably you see that no more brought out than when you have a hyperinflation or a war. And this book is about both, isn't it?
It is. Mr. Ferguson has been a member of the European Parliament. He was a special advisor at the Foreign Office, and it was a part of European Affairs for International Industry and Commerce, as well as a political advisor during Maggie Thatcher's government. So, you know, he comes to the issue from an official position, decision maker, as someone who is influencing decisions. And yet this is a very personal tale, wanting to appreciate the impact of inflation on his family, on Great Britain. Because keep in mind, in the 1970s, inflation was raging there, just as it was in the United States. And it was creating social disruption. It was creating workers' strikes. It was creating pain for savers and those living on a fixed income. And so these are issues that people encounter, and they are real world issues where the rubber meets the road.
Well, and you know, so often when we're talking to clients, they're like, you know, I don't necessarily understand what the CPI is. I don't understand all the things you talk about as far as numbers, charts, statistics. What I understand is the human element, the impact that it's going to have on my family. And really, when he wrote this book, that's what it was about. He didn't want to make it an economic book. He wanted to make it a human experience book because there's pain.
There is this idea of what has government done to our money. And, you know, the conversations that I've had around the dinner table, and I think these are conversations that everyone should have around the dinner table, is that inflation is a perennial issue. Inflation is something that governments around the world in all periods of time do to their currency. They overpromise in an attempt to gain votes. They overpromise and overspend and ultimately play the catch-up game via printing more money to get that done. So this is not something that is just an issue in sort of, 80 years ago, 90 years ago in Weimar Germany. This goes back to the 3rd century. This goes back to the 2nd century. This goes back to, as far as you can take recorded history back, we have struggled with inflation. We saw this with the denarius. We've seen it with the pound sterling perennially. We have seen it with, obviously, the German mark. In the modern context, we have, in fact, the U.S. State Department has created a hyperinflation in Iran in the last 24 months. So these are things that, whether it's past tense for the historian or present tense for the current market observer, are real concerns, because ultimately, who are we concerned about? Real people, our families.
Well, we've read many books on inflation. I would have to probably put this at the very top of the reading list. That's why I was thrilled that Adam Ferguson today is our guest.
Keynes said that not one in a million understood inflation, and that may be true even after going through a severe inflation. Money printing is very often not seen as the cause, but what we do have are the experiences of people during episodes of inflation, which have left their own unique scar tissue. I think what makes the book When Money Dies a particularly important and unique book in the variety of books that have been written on inflation is it deals with people and money, not just money and statistics. And so when you're dealing with a nightmarish scenario, I think this brings a very unique insight. You had Jacques Rouff, who wrote The Monetary Sin of the West in the late 1960s. You had Hayek, who received the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1974. Adam Ferguson, thanks for joining us. You wrote When Money Dies in 1975. What was your motivation for writing it?
Well, my book was never intended as one strictly on economics. In the early 1970s in Britain, we were at the beginning of one of the worst inflations that we'd had during the 20th century. And I was deeply disturbed to see the effect of inflation on people, including me and my family. of the steady collapse in value of their money, although it never reached more than 22% in a matter of a few years. But we were frightened. We were searching for safer places to keep our money, looking at other currencies, material goods, better shares, anything but bonds. And inflation was causing social disruption, pain for savers, prompting strikes for higher wages for those who could strike, which was, of course, no resort for the self-employed or pensioners. And there was signs of panic and corruption, which were not so very far apart. So I decided then to examine the classic case of severe inflation, which was post-World War I Germany, to see how they reacted. And I found that if you have the same disease, you have the same symptoms and the same sort of human misbehavior and misery in whatever proportions. I think that answers your question.
Very much so. Now, it seems that today we have a similar iteration. And again, if you're talking about the disease and the symptoms, today we have the Bank of Japan and the Fed. These are government-run pyramid schemes expanding the monetary base to buy government bonds. And so with that as sort of a current tense backdrop, let's look at all stages of inflation. Let's look at all episodes of inflation. Some periods are quite benign. Low levels of inflation, not particularly concerning. And then you have others which are very malignant. What are those stages, and when should we be concerned? Is there a point of no return?
Well, it's a good question. In an economic society, inflation strikes unfairly, which is, say, sometimes benign, sometimes it's malignant. The most vulnerable and the old, those on fixed incomes, savers, self-employed, anyone who has no protection and nowhere to run, they are the people who suffer. Others, like speculators and people with heavy debts, may benefit from it. But no one benefits more than over-indebted governments. And it's their deliberate money creation which causes inflation and reduces the real value of what they have borrowed. So you've got both the benign and the malignant, if that's not too strong a word about governments, to consider. Central banks tend nowadays to hold that a 2% inflation rate is beneficial and that it guards against the contrasting but not strictly opposite danger of deflation. But I would say that 2% inflation, deliberate by the government, is robbery just the same. The danger point, because you were asking the point of no return, is when people lose their trust in money and don't want to hold it. It's when the bank loses control and the quantity of money becomes less significant in causing values to drop than the velocity of its circulation. So that is, I think, the point of no return is when the bank loses control because it has lost the trust of the people.
No, inflation is something that is confusing to many people. What is it about inflation that people should care about?
I think the answer is, again, it's what it does to the vulnerable. It is the fact that it comes back to what the nature of money is, which people often think they understand and which governments often do not. What is money? It is the repository of trust. And the people who are responsible for maintaining that trust are the people who should care. The responsibility of those in charge of the trust in people's money is enormous. And that's what we should care about.
You've said in the book, When Money Dies, what really broke Germany was the constant taking of the soft political option in respect to money. The road to hyperinflation was not merely one of financial missteps, but it had a moral component to it as well. Could you explain that?
Yes, but neither Germany's government nor its central bank understood monetary theory. They really believed that inflation demanded the printing of ever more money rather than that money printing caused inflation. And this ignorance was, of course, fatal. The demand grew almost exponentially for banknotes of ever greater denominations to buy ever more expensive goods. It didn't stop, and the government and the banks found they were riding a tiger. Post-First World War Germany was threatened by putsches, by Red Revolution following Russia's in 1917, by vast unemployment, and of course the cost of war reparations. And the political difficulty was huge of withholding the banknotes from a starving, desperate population whose army had been defeated. The printing could only be stopped eventually when banknotes had become completely worthless and a new currency was actually possible.
You know, we look at all of the anecdotes that you chronicle, a fascinating study that you've done, most of it drawn from journals and personal experiences, firsthand accounts of what individuals and their families went through. But as you chronicle all of these anecdotes from 1919 through 1924 and the hyperinflation, which do you feel best capture the effects of inflation on people and on communities, ultimately on nations?
Yes. There are, of course, so many stories, like the starving townspeople who went into the countryside to take the food that the farmers found no financial points in bringing to the market. Corruption was breaking out among the previously incorruptible in the civil service, this sort of thing. But I would like to mention the episode in, I think, September 1923, when the mark's value against the dollar was rising so fast that the trade unions didn't even know how much to strike for. But what they should have come out for was striking for a stable value for the money they had. And this is a very central part of the whole inflation illusion. People think their money is going up when in fact it's going down against whatever benchmark you happen to choose. In the case of Germany, it was always the dollar.
I had this conversation with my boys last night, and the idea that they would have more money in the context of inflation was immediately appealing to them.
Exactly.
And then when I was describing the loss of efficacy, I thought the only way that they'll fully understand this is if I pour a glass of whiskey. And so I did. I poured a glass of Irish whiskey and allowed them to dip their finger in it just to taste how powerful and strong it was. And then I poured in a gallon of water and had them smell and taste again. And there was nothing left of what you would consider real substance.
I like that. It has been easy to be in Zimbabwe today. People are millionaires because their banknotes have $10 billion written on them. But it means nothing.
Well, I left the boys as multimillionaires last night, one with a 10 million mark note and the other with a 2 million mark note. There was obviously some feeling of unfairness in the 2 versus the 10. But back to the German inflation. The German inflation really made Hitler's rule possible. And of course, there was the votes that he needed, which were provided by the high rates of unemployment present in that era. Do you attribute his success? Do you attribute his success to the Treaty of Versailles and the seeds of conflict that were planted by the Allies?
To some extent, it was true then that the seeds of the next war were always implanted in the previous peace treaty. And certainly the resentment against the terms of Versailles were very, very great. And Hitler was able to expand on that, both in the very early 20s and after he'd been in prison in the late 20s. But it is a cynical but not unarguable view that in Europe, World War II was simply an extension of World War I when Germany had recovered enough to continue it. But hyperinflation and the political and social unhappiness it brought really destroyed the chances of real democracy taking root in post-imperial Germany at all. And the Weimar Republic's chances of success were finally knocked on the head by the Great Depression, which came, after all, quite a long time, 5 or 6 years after the great inflation had ended. And the Great Depression was Hitler's moment to come forward and pretend and succeed in becoming the strong leader that Germany thought it needed.
Yeah, clearly it's not axiomatic that hyperinflations create Hitlers.
No.
We do see social chaos. We see sort of violent blame shifting and people searching for answers in the context of both a monetary and financial chaos.
Yes. The idea that it caused Hitler, I don't think it's an idea particularly worth pursuing in terms of historical explanations of what happened. But it's certainly a factor.
So we know that hyperinflation comes at a high cost, really, to everyone. Who bears the cost of a minor inflation, and is a hyperinflation very different?
I think the answer to that is that we all bear the cost, financially, morally, socially. The dollar and the pound, for example, have lost far more than 3/4 of their purchasing power since my book was written. Now, that was nearly 40 years ago, and I think the pound is down by 9/10. Now, that would be hyperinflation if it had taken place over a couple of years. So the difference between inflation and hyperinflation, you could say, is not in quantity, but in time. But, of course, there's all the difference between a gale and a whirlwind. If we compare what the forces of nature that are going through and can be coped with, In the Gale, they can be coped with. In the Wildwood, they can't.
So the compression of time, the intensification of the event, and it being really unbearable in a shorter time frame, as you suggest, though, the consequences are as severe, though less recognized, if you look at the loss of 9/10 of purchasing power, or this is the pound sterling. What was the world's reserve currency, the U.S. dollar, 3/4 of its value lost as well, or more, in the same time frame. And yet, because it was stretched over a long enough period of time, we go back to that notion that Keynes, you know, said not one in a million understands inflation. In fact, the folks that are managing our money system today would say that what they have gained for us in the context of slaughtering our currencies has in fact been beneficial because we've avoided the inflation or the deflation boogeyman.
I don't think that deflation and inflation are exact opposites. The effects of both. I mean, if inflation was bad, then deflation should logically be a good, but it's not. And what everyone really needs is stability. And these two concepts come on either side of stability, and one is a negative in curiously different ways.
Well, you know, inflation and deflation, not exact opposites, as you say. And there is episodes, in fact, of deflation being quite positive in terms of an increase in purchasing power for the individual. And yet this benefit to society is not taxable by government. So there tends to be this inflationary bias, I think in part because it becomes, in nominal terms, a great boon to government, an increase in revenues year after year.
No question that inflation is something which has been here for a long time and always be with us, because it is any government's way of eliminating debt run up over things that have not been productive at all, whether it's your welfare services or your army abroad or whatever. These are not productive matters, and inflation alone can help governments to pay for such possibly perfectly beneficial things. But inflation is something which governments have always and always will indulge in and try to get away with as much of it as possible. To ask for stability of the currency they produce when they're running up debts of that kind is simply not realistic, which is unfortunate, and it affects us all. The question is to what extent that these deliberately inflationary policies, necessary ones perhaps, can be controlled and can be stopped from getting out of control.
The last 5 years, we've seen plenty of creativity applied to monetary policy making. Out-of-the-box thinking, you could say. One of our commentary guests, Andrew Hussar, he was the director of the first round of quantitative easing, the purchasing of better than $1 trillion in mortgage-backed securities. And, you know, it makes us reflect on deficit financing of this kind. This may have been a stopgap measure. Has that proven itself effective in the past, deficit financing? And regardless of the euphemism, quantitative easing, isn't money printing still just money printing?
They are staggering sums, what you're talking about. But I think that today we are into a new ball game, which is still imperfectly understood. Huge QE, quantitative easing, and low interest rates, which we have on either side of the Atlantic, don't sit comfortably together, even as twin crutches to boost an economy. Neither in Britain, nor in the US, nor in the Eurozone, in all of whom I think inflation has been curiously low, except rather tellingly in the housing sector, can we be sure where this new money has all gone, or where it may be lurking, or what pressures it might create one day, and what mayhem it may yet cause. We don't know where it is. It certainly has not gone where it was originally intended that it should go. And yes, there have been many examples from the Mississippi bubble or the French Revolution to Pennsylvania in the 1840s, of deficit financing which has gone wildly wrong. I can't think of any large-scale example that has gone right, but it depends what you mean by effective. Many pensioners and holders of bonds and many importers would not agree that it's been effective at all. Others might say it has saved them from immediate disaster. But what does effective mean? Certainly, it has helped governments out of immediate problems, but it has almost always landed them in bigger ones later.
The scale and the scope of debt, it seems that the first signs of real stress and strain in the financial markets come from an overcommitment, long-term obligations which can't ultimately be met, which brings out the temptation to inflate. And we've got a unique situation in the United States that we can, at any point, and perhaps this is true of any government, but we can at any point change the methods that we use to count inflation so that we may create it and we may cover over it. And it takes some sleuthing to determine what real rates of inflation are. But it seems that our foreign creditors are today comfortable with official rates of inflation being in that 1.8 to 2.1% range, although the realities that the consumer faces are quite different. Maybe it's 2 or 4 or even 6 or 8%, depending on the methods used to count inflation. One thing that is different, perhaps, now versus in other periods of inflation, we think of Weimar Germany, we think of Zimbabwe more recently, Hungary in the 90s. Banknotes are not as physically critical to the economy as they once were. Credit is the new currency, whether it's credit cards, debit cards. We can digitally create billions, hundreds of billions, out of nothing in a nanosecond. Does this change in the nature of money from a physical bill to something of credit, does that alter your views on inflation?
Yes, it must have changed things in every possible way. And I think that trust has become even more critical. Trust in the constancy and the stability of the currency has become even more critical, and especially in relation to the velocity of circulation. As I say, we're in a new ball game when, as you said yourself, credit can be created so quickly, or by citizens themselves with their own credit cards. In Germany of the 20s, there was a physical limit to the outpouring of banknotes. Now there is absolutely none to money creation. And indeed, what we see in Europe, in America, in Britain, often promises that the amount of extra money, if it's needed, will be unlimited. And this should be terrifying. The central banks must be playing with fire. But why people are not yet terrified by this, the total availability of endless money, is not entirely clear, and that is why things have changed.
So much of your book reflects on the consequences of inflation for people, and we discussed earlier there being a moral component. What happens to values, not the values of things, but the values of people in the context of a severe inflation?
This was very much what I was studying when I wrote the book. And the answer, in as much as it is an answer, is that no one knows best how to respond to severe inflation. Their character almost changes. They become suspicious that others know better and are doing and are coping better with the problems than they are. So much is viewed still today as then in terms of money, social status, possessions, prospects. And when the security of wealth disappears, values deteriorate, moral values. Corruption may follow. And in due course, social cohesion breaks down. So I think that is the answer. An unstable currency, when you can't trust what you are used to trusting as a measure of everything important to you, when that happens, the knock-on effects socially, morally, politically are inevitable and unfortunate.
You know, reflecting back to the anecdotes you shared earlier, there's a family in our office who went through the hyperinflation, and the family loaned money to a neighbor to build a house. And that debt was paid off. The loan was paid off in the context of the hyperinflation with a single chicken. Some have suggested that inflation profiteering, that is sort of borrowing money and paying it back with devalued currency units, runs the risk of that debt being indexed or marked up, even on a retroactive basis. You have this contrast of a large sum of money paid off with a single chicken or the indexing of debt. Is this a real concern?
I suppose, of course, it must be. It comes back to the question of trust in money. That is, trust betrayed. I suppose it must be a real concern. And retrospective recoveries by treasuries are certainly not uncommon, and they're certainly unpopular as well. But profiteering at the scale that was done in Germany, and not only just by single people repaying a large debt with a chicken, but in what was done by the great profiteers who were borrowing money from the central bank, setting up factories, and then paying the debts, the cost of those factories with the cost of a week's profits of the manufacturers they were producing. There were many examples of that, and that grossly upset the German economy at the time. The vast industrialists who took Germany for a ride on the basis of borrowing cheaply and paying back later at phenomenally small rates.
You know, there is tensions that can be felt as you look at capital flows. Today, you might look at the Treasury reports of money that's leaving China and some of the unexpected changes, perhaps, that the ruling class is going through as they moderate the business model that they've used for the last 20 or 30 years and are anticipating significant changes. We see capital flight in that instance. Well, that's a modern day issue, but it's also a past tense issue. What does capital flight tell you about a currency's perceived value?
It must once again reflect lack of trust, long-term trust, in a money, in a currency. And it happens probably at every level, I would think, whether popular or international or commercial or concerning investments. People will get out of a currency if they feel that their money is no longer safe there. Capital flight in a big way, I don't know enough about it to be able to say, but it's not only capital flight, but the long-term effects, for example, of American trade with China, where China is now holds a vast amount of U.S. Treasury bonds, which it can't get rid of. America and China are locked together in a sort of wrestling hold. Neither can let go. If China gets rid of its American bonds, then the value to them will collapse as well. It's a sort of mutual destruction situation, which economists sort of look at aghast and wonder how anything is going to be unscrambled at all. Capital flight, yes, it obviously indicates total lack of belief that any currency or any economy is going to last. We have this coming up at the moment in Britain at the moment, where the possible but unlikely prospect that Scotland and England will separate. Already there is much talk of people getting their money out of Scotland, the banks leaving Scotland, industry leaving Scotland, if by any chance Scotland were to go independent. That is capital flight, and it certainly has close relations to perception of the value of the currency.
There, in almost every past period of monetary mayhem, there was a hard currency alternative to flee to. Even in the 1970s, you had the Swiss franc, which was largely, significantly, gold-backed. Where do global capital flows go in a world of entirely fiat currency choices?
It's a fine question. On a personal, individual level, gold bugs will tell you one thing, gold. Your stockbroker will tell you another. Art dealers and that sort of people will tell you a third. But global capital, bitcoins, the spreading capital widely is the easy, usual answer to the question, where do you go? And of course, you may be lucky. But there we are again. The world has changed. It's not much good going into the Swiss franc any longer. Gold goes up and down. We used to go for the dollar, but that goes up and down. And the answer is nobody knows. My answer is that I don't know.
There are similarities today, maybe just at the front edge in terms of similarities. The investment markets today are driven by speculation, and those living on a fixed income pressured to take more and more risk to meet their income needs. And, you know, perhaps it was different. The currency markets were one of the main places where you saw forced speculation in the Weimar period. But investors are not judging things on the basis of risk or absolute values. They are looking on the basis of necessity at meeting needs. And that already speaks to a certain level of desperation because of monetary policy. And yet our monetary policy mavens, they are not connecting the dots and seeing that they're creating problems as well as potentially solutions in other areas. What could we learn from the people in Germany, the banks who said, the mark is the mark, with this sort of undying sense of destiny and permanence?
What do we learn from Germany? What is interesting is what Germany has learned from its own past. They have become, and one of the reasons why the Eurozone is today in such a sort of tight bind with itself, is because of Germany's own obsession, because it has had its hyperinflation twice in the last 8 years, obsession with the real value of money, of maintaining, of fighting inflation at every possible moment. The basis of the euro, after all, is that inflation, it must remain stable as the Deutschmark was before Germany joined it. It comes back once again, if I can go on about this for a second, about the nature of money, which is still under discussion. It is surely, supremely money, a store of trust, whether it comes in gold coins or seashells or paper promises. And those responsible for it mustn't betray that trust. I'm talking of governments, central bankers, economists. And this applies more greatly than ever, I think, to the dollar, which is the only real reserve currency in the world, which makes the Fed's responsibility for maintaining the value of and the stability of the dollar, their responsibility is global, yet it understandably acts principally in the national interest. So the Fed there also has a problem. Its responsibilities are worldwide because of the nature of the dollar, and yet it has to, at the same time, to cover its very important duty of looking after the domestic dollar first and foremost. And often these two duties have to conflict. I come back once again to my main message. Trust in money is the only important thing to maintain.
We thank you so much for taking the time to explore, to exercise your curiosity in the 1970s and continue to ask questions and seek for the answers to what the effects would be on your family. You've opened up unique insights beyond the statistical revelations of loss of purchasing power and, you know, again, numbers that sometimes people, when you get into the billions and trillions in terms of those figures, lose touch with. And you've done a masterful job of connecting the reader with the realities of inflation, with the familial realities, with the individual stresses and strains, with the issues of national identity and loss of purpose. There are many things here that are of a psychological and social nature. And I think you've made a very significant contribution to the understanding of inflation. And so we thank you for joining us today and look forward to any books that you may be printing. Again, it took us a long time to see this book be reprinted, and I hope it's selling well. I know that through our office, we've recommended it to thousands and thousands of people as an invaluable resource for understanding the nature of inflation.
You're very, very kind, and thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Adam Ferguson. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.